from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, the decade in food. The first 10 years of the 21st century have ushered in new culinary trends in restaurants, our own kitchens, even on the streets. The senior editor of Chow Magazine joins us for a look at how the economy, concerns about the environment, and the rise of social networking sites like Twitter and Facebook are changing our palates and what's hot in the marketplace. And of course, we want to hear from you. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Well, this week marks the final days of the 21st century's first decade. Good riddance, say a lot of people. And this hour, we're going to lighten it up a bit and look back and ahead at some of the most important and fun trends in food over the past 10 years. And what we're eating and drinking and how is a tasty lens through which to look through the past few years. And joining us to do just that is Leslie Anderson. She's senior editor of Chow.com, an online magazine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, take us back 10 years, if you would. 1999, very different scene economically and culturally. What was going on then and in food?
Yes. Well, so people sometimes don't even realize that what they eat and, you know, how they think about food changes over time. And it's sometimes it takes a turn of a decade to give us the opportunity to look back and see that one meal at a time, things do change and these larger trends emerge. And so at Chow.com, we decided to do that. And we look back at 1999. First of all, we were in the middle of this dot-com bubble. It had yet to burst. People had a lot of disposable income. And when it came to food and dining, the name of the game was, how much can you impress your neighbor, your friend, your business associate, your venture capitalist? And the way that that played out was expensive bottles of wine, parties where there were mountains of prawns and oysters. And, you know, the more perishable the shellfish, the better, because, of course, that meant, you know, it was expensive. We had vodka coming out of, you know, ice sculptures and tables at French Laundry reserved 6 months in advance that you could brag to your friends about, you know, having in your back pocket.
And, of course, that ended right around 2000, I guess. It began to, you know, the dot-com bust began to happen.
That's right.
To what extent, you know, was that just a reflection, the food of the time, was it a reflection of what was going on versus, you know, driving sort of the culture at that time, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think the two things went hand in hand. A lot of that money that people had was kind of fake money. You know, it was venture capital. It was Amex cards. And when you went out to dinner, it was like it wasn't even your money that you were spending. So it was all sort of driving one another, these trends.
When you think back to that time, what are some of the restaurants that were hot and the sort of some of the other food trends that were hot then that disappeared as the years went by?
Sure. Well, first of all, if you compare the names of restaurants back then to the restaurants now, you can see it was sort of hubris versus humbleness. Some of the restaurants that were popular back then were Paragon, Vertigo, MC Squared, The Globe. Nowadays, we have Spork, Dirt Candy in New York City, Fish and Farm in San Francisco, Flour and Water.
Basics.
Back to basics. Peasant in New York. Now, Peasant is, you know, was Frank Bruni's favorite restaurant, but Peasant, just so apropos of the time.
Although, you know, I went to Flour and Water the other night, and it's right here in the neighborhood. And although you're right, it's very rustic. It's not simple in the sense that they have some fairly... complex ingredients. There are a lot of words on the menu that I didn't know, and I think of myself as being fairly smart. I'm wondering, is it a kind of a faux rustic?
Well, it's a rustic, but they're going for an Italian rustic. And the Italian rustic trend is an interesting one because now we're, of course, in the middle of recession. People don't have a lot of money to throw around. And they aren't as interested in experimenting. They're not as interested in going to a restaurant and getting something that might not fill them up. You know, it might be one small dollop of something on a big plate. And the Italian trend, which Flour and Water is doing, people like Italian because they feel like they're getting a lot for their money. And a lot of those words are, you know, they're some sort of pasta you've never tried before, or there's some sort of house-made charcuterie, a sausage that you've never tried before. But still in that realm of, you know, stick to your ribs, good old-fashioned Italian food.
And you mentioned Italian food being a good deal. It's hard to find a restaurant these days without pizza on the menu.
That's right. And specifically, pizza with an egg on top, we've noticed.
What is that? I mean, it's good. I've had it. But is that a California invention, or do they do that in Italy? I mean, where did that come from?
That is an Italian thing. I mean, it originated here. The trend originated here in San Francisco at Delfina. I think Delfina Pizzeria was the first one to do it, and then everyone just kind of jumped on the bandwagon. Again, it's this comfort food thing. It's sort of like eating your brunch and your pizza at the same time, and the gooey yolk gets all over. I love it.
Yeah, but no coffee with pizza.
No.
Coming back, though, to this notion of simplicity and being rustic, the prices don't necessarily reflect that, do they?
Yes and no. For a place like Flower and Water, you're going out on a date and you're paying sort of a lot for pizza and a bottle of wine. But what we have seen, which is an interesting new trend that I think reflects the economic times, is this trend of people getting really excited about street food. So back in 1999, this is very un-PC probably, but people referred to street food as roach coach or roach coaches. Nowadays, you have fancy chefs who actually start their own food carts where they're selling everything from, you know, natural casing, homemade hot dogs.
Creme brulee,
escargot on skewers. They're getting
and
really
these are literally
fancy.
Carts. I mean,
literally carts. They're either carts, like I've seen guys riding bikes with good old-fashioned buckets attached and little propane burners, to people who actually get taco trucks and kind of retrofit them out.
And there's kind of a mashup going on with the taco trucks, too. I mean, that started, I think, in L.A., where you'd have like Korean barbecue tortillas or burritos.
That's right. Yeah, there was a very famous operation in L.A. that started about a year and a half ago called Kogi Taco, Kogi Barbecue Taco. And it was a chef and his friend, and they started this truck and basically meshed Korean food and LA street taco to great success. And the 2009 twist on that was that they used Twitter, of course, to tell all the kids where they were going to be with their truck. And they'd show up at UCLA and there'd be like a million kids that had been out drinking, eating their tacos.
Just humor me for a minute and explain how they use Twitter.
So Twitter is a service where you can, you know, sort of type out and send out to your subscriber list very few characters, just where you're going to be. And you can subscribe to different people's, you know, feed. They call it a Twitter feed. And then you get these updates on your cell phone or your computer, you know, wherever it is that you want to get it.
So you subscribe to the creme brulee guy's Twitter feed, and he says, I'm going to be at the corner of Sansom and Battery, or I don't know if that is a corner, Sansom and Broadway, at noon today. And people show up.
That's right. And it's great if you're perhaps if you don't have a real food license to sell, you know, if you're illegally doing it, you're constantly on the run. You don't actually have a physical address.
Yeah. Well, what about that? Because there is a lot less regulation. Is that a trend? Is this a trend that's waiting to go bust, you know, the first time somebody gets really sick from a food cart?
I don't know. I think that remains to be seen. I mean, there's always been those guys out on Mission Street selling the hot dogs with the bacon wrapped up, ready to just cart their whole operation away in a van the minute they see a policeman. And the thing about street food that people get, I think, sometimes paranoid or confused about is they think it's less sanitary. Sometimes it's actually a lot more sanitary because, A, they're cooking it right in front of you. And B, it's so they can't hide, you know, unsanitary conditions. And B, it's fresh. I mean, it's being made right there.
Although they don't necessarily have a place to wash up.
Well, that's true.
Oh, listen to me. I'm such a cynic. I want to get your thoughts about how brick and mortar restaurants are reacting to that trend, because they're not paying rent. They're much more mobile. They're very it's low budget in a way. Do they feel threatened by that, some of the more traditional restaurants, or are they getting in on the trend themselves?
Well, the more forward-thinking chefs are absolutely getting in on the trend. I mean, we've seen Charles Fan with Slanted Door doing Out the Door at the Ferry Building. A lot of chefs...
That's still fairly traditional, though. I mean, it's not a cart, for example.
Oh,
I mean,
right. Yeah.
It's not, to go.
It's not a cart. That's true. But, you know, the chef at Shea Spencer, he did his Spencer on the Go cart, where he took a taco truck and started selling this very high-end French food out of a truck. Now, I don't know how well that truck is doing. It had sort of a symbiotic relationship with the wine bar across the street, which I notice is now closed for renovations. I don't know what's going on, but...
Yeah. Well, listen, we're going to open up the phone lines a little early this hour because I know everyone likes to talk about food, and you can tell us about your favorite food trend or what you miss, a trend that disappeared perhaps that you miss, or what food blogs do you read and why, and have you Yelped a restaurant lately? Give us a call. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, 866-733-6786. And, of course, you can also send your comments by email. It's forum@kqed.org. Our guest is Leslie Anderson, senior editor of Chow.com. And I want to ask you about Chow.com. Chowhound existed, and I called it a magazine earlier. It's not really a magazine. It's sort of an online publication, right?
Well, so Chow began as a print magazine 4 or 5 years ago, and Chowhound was a separate site that users could – you know, people could go to the site and plug in their comments about restaurants and share hot tips on, you know, where to get corn crepes in Queens and so on and so forth. Now, Chow Magazine and Chowhound were both bought by a company which was called CNET, merged together, and now we're one. Now we're also owned by CBS because CBS bought CNET.
How does that change the operation, if I might add? I mean, when you get a big corporate owner like that, I can see you're like, don't ask me that. But, you know, does it change the culture?
It's actually been really great.
You have to say that.
No, I'm serious. Well, for one thing, you know, I don't have to pay for stamps myself. We have an HR department. No, it really has been great because CBS understands media, obviously, and we've had such a great opportunity to get our videos out to other sources and really have more people hear about food trends and great recipes that we produce.
And, of course, one of the big trends in addition to street food is blogging, which you all do. And everyone's a critic. Everyone's a food critic with Yelp and their own blogs. What do you make of that? Where's that going? And, you know, is it a good thing?
I think in general, it is a good thing. I think that you know, there's this theory about the most prized information these days comes from your network of close friends. It's, you know, why Facebook has gotten so popular. If your close friend tells you, you know, you have to go check out Flour and Water. This is really, I know what you like. I know what you like, Scott. You're going to love it. Just go. You're going to go. Whereas, you know, if you read Michael Bauer, yeah, you know, maybe you don't like Michael Bauer. Maybe you think, you know.
Although he loved it too. He loved Flour and Water also.
Well, you're really going to go now. So I think that the rise of the informal critic, the amateur critic, is in general a good thing because it allows you to parse information and get the information that is really going to help you. Of course, the loss there is that we have people that are trained critics and people that have a broader context to analyze, you know, cultural trends, food trends, and sometimes, you know, your next door neighbor isn't going to have that.
Yeah. So what happens to the Michael Bauers of the world?
I think that there is. Their role right now is in question, but I think that as we move forward, people are going to rediscover the expert.
Restaurants have a real mixed feeling about Yelp, I'm sure. I know that the waiters at Delfina, which we mentioned earlier on 18th Street near Dolores Park, they wear some of them, or they have in the past, I don't know if they always do, they wear T-shirts with sort of sarcastic messages about Yelp. Because apparently, you know, you get every restaurant that has a lot of customers is going to get a bad comment every now and then. And it could be the guy down the street who owns a competing restaurant. You don't really know necessarily. It is anonymous.
Yes, that's true. It is anonymous. You don't know who's going to be sitting at your table. Sometimes the dead giveaway is when they get out a very complicated, nerdy contraption and start taking pictures of their food right in the restaurant.
There you go. And they're emailing it to 1,000 people before the check comes.
Yeah, I find that to be a bit of a buzzkill myself.
Let's go to the phones. Again, that number, 866-733-6786. And our first stop is Menlo Park. Julie's on the line. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So due to economic situations and others, I'm cooking more at home, and my favorite food trend is locally grown food, but with a twist. I have found a way to get locally grown meats, and there's nothing like freshly grown, freshly processed chicken. You cannot buy anything like this in a grocery store to cook for yourself at home.
Chickens in Menlo Park? How local are we talking?
We are talking 4-H kids who grow these animals. They process them themselves. They sell them locally. It happens every year at the county fairs. The fair season starts in May and runs through August or September. So there's a period of time that you can get fresh chicken, fresh turkey, and I've never had anything like this.
Who butchers them?
Sometimes the kids do, but when you buy from the fair, they all go to a USDA-inspected poultry processing plant.
And are your friends doing this as well?
My friends? Yes. Actually, there has been a network of people who have gotten in touch using technology like Facebook and Yahoo groups, and that's how they find where to get this meat from.
Interesting. Leslie Anderson, what do you think of that? Have you heard of that? People, you hear chickens. Like, you're right in this neighborhood. You hear chickens from time to time.
To me,
again, there's a limit, I think, in the city, how many chickens you can have.
There are some regulations about that. But, yeah, to me, that is one of the most exciting happy trends of this, you know, of this time right now is the what we call the DIY, you know, the do-it-yourself kind of urban or, you know, suburban farming. You know, people are keeping chickens, these 4-H kids like you're talking about. I mean, how wonderful. And then also people are keeping their own bees and having local honey. I've seen honey that hails from San Francisco proper. I'm sure people have bees on their roofs and things.
All right, Julie, thanks for the call. Let's go now to another Julie in Walnut Creek. Good morning.
Good morning. I've been excited to see the way that food network type programs have generated a lot more excitement for my kids in terms of cooking, and it's given them a vocabulary with which they can sort of describe their experience when we do dine out.
Like which shows do they watch?
Well, we especially like Alton Brown's Good Eats because it's educational. He gives you a background about where the products have come from or maybe their historical context. And then when we do go out and dine, there's this added interest in maybe trying ingredients or dishes that might have been intimidating in the past.
Hmm. And
I think, I was just going to say, paired with that is I love the way restaurants have become even more accessible. When we went to New York recently to visit, we went to the Harrison, which is Amanda Freitag's. We went to Kraft, which is Tom Colicchio's, and even though these are celebrity chef venues, they were very gracious, they were very accommodating, and I felt that they reached out to the children as well.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Leslie Anderson, this notion, you know, there are a lot of TV shows. There's the whole Food Network now, of course. What do you think of these sort of Top Chef, these competition programs? The original one was Iron Chef, which came out of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an American version of Iron Chef, and now there's just a huge proliferation of them. What do you make of them?
Well, I know that Top Chef has been enormously successful, obviously, but it's also been really inspiring to people who don't really know how to cook. And I've talked to a lot of people about that. And my theory for why that is because most cooking shows, you know, they come on, they have all their prep already done, everything's chopped up in the little bowl. They put together something and then there's this immediate, you know, collapsing of time and it comes out of the oven all perfect. So it's this unattainable process. Whereas on Top Chef, you see people, you know, sweating it in the kitchen and making mistakes and not knowing how to do a brunoise. And it's like you're learning along with them and you get this peek inside how hard it really is. And learning how hard something is actually kind of inspiring.
You know, I want to go back to the point the first caller made about local. Local is a huge trend, of course, nowadays, and a lot of people credit or blame Alice Waters for this. And I say blame because although she is a hero to many people in the culinary world, there is some criticism of her from people like Anthony Bourdain recently, from people who say that she is such an influence on restaurants and foodies in the Bay Area that it's smothering in a way, that it's stifling competition, not competition, but creativity. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that that might be a little bit of a New York attitude coming in. Recently, another New York chef, David Chang, was out here and made a big controversial statement about how nothing is creative in San Francisco cuisine, and people just think I probably shouldn't paraphrase it, but basically he said something like people are just putting a fig on a plate and acting like it's, you know, the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah, no, I've got the article here. I'm trying to quickly find it, but yeah, it was sort of that reference to people. If it's raw and local, it's good enough. You know, that's really what people are looking for.
Right, and I think it's an unfair criticism. I think that in New York there is a bluster and there is a kind of an old boys thing where people are trying to really – they're trying to do something new, but oftentimes what they're doing is not that new. They're just trying to, you know, make it look like it's new and exciting.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Mike is on the line in Berkeley. Good morning, Mike.
Yes, good morning. Great program, folks.
Thank you.
Really enjoy it. I'm a longtime resident of Bay Area before, but I live in L.A. back and forth now. And I just wanted to comment on something earlier that you said as far as street vending, because we are truly embattling this situation in L.A. What people thought that was cute and cultural early on has now come to almost every corner selling food and goods and products. And the economic situation infuriating people in the neighborhoods as law enforcement doesn't really code enforce it. They have found homes with, you know, rancid meat and products and whatnot before hitting the streets, and with no regulation or permit, and of course sanitary conditions, and oftentimes the money, cash flow, is going right into their pockets and out of the country, which is not helping us as our stores close and quality of life issues are driven down, down, down. It's I'm seeing it in East Oakland here. I'm seeing it in parts of Mission, and it is a very, very slippery slope.
You're seeing the impact on the brick-and-mortar buildings, restaurants as well?
Yes. I mean, even things as far as trucks that have health code regulations and permits and pay their taxes and whatnot, thus helping with the cash flow and the revenue in the community, are becoming very upset with people that just open up shop on the corner, start, you know, cooking food of any age or whatnot, selling that and cash flow right into the pocket and out of the community. And it's a very dangerous thing that's, you know, health code regulation scary, and also then we're seeing goods and products set up all around that people are, you know, thus not going into the stores and contributing to the community, but again, it's not helping all the way around. It's strictly, number one, is a health code violation.
All right.
Not being regulated.
I guess, Leslie, sort of buyer beware in those cases. But that's true of, you know, any time you go to a farmer's market or anything else. I mean, you want to keep an eye on the quality of it, even in a supermarket. You look at the date when it was packed and when it expires and all those things. But I guess what the caller is saying is that there are fewer hints that you can go by when you're buying food from a vendor as to whether it's healthy or not.
Right. And I think the caller's also pointing to this idea that, yeah, it might be fun and it might be creative and it might be cute and all that, but these businesses or you know, these carts are actually taking business away from, you know, tax paying actual businesses.
They're what are the most unusual food carts you're aware of? We mentioned creme brulees. I think you said, escargot on a stick?
Oh, yeah, that's Spencer on the Go food truck. There's a waffle truck I've seen. The creme brulee one was interesting because he had all these different flavors. You'd always have an alcoholic one like Bailey's.
All right, we have much more to talk about in the rest of this half hour. Our guest is Leslie Anderson, senior editor of Chow.com. And join our conversation by calling 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or as always, you can email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning. And my guest this hour is Leslie Anderson. She's the senior editor of Chow.com. We're looking back at the decade in food. And we'd love to hear from you, 866-733-6786. Let's go to Robert in Belmont. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks. Great show this morning. I've been curious and excited about the increased interest and availability of Belgian beers and Belgian-style beers I've seen over the last couple of years. It's really seeming to be taking off. I'm wondering what's fueling that, if you have any comment on that.
Sure. Leslie?
Well, I am very excited about that trend. I'm somewhat of a beer geek myself. So first of all, let's look back at 99. The big drink then was vodka, which I think was sort of perfect for the time because of everybody's interest in high-tech, high technology. You can't get more high-tech than vodka. It's had everything stripped out of it through column stills, you know, within an inch of its life. No smell, no taste, very little texture. Now, you know, fast forward 10 years, and we have the most funky, rustic quaffs, these Belgian beers and Belgian-style beers.
And what is Belgian-style beer? What makes it unique?
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of beer that they make in Belgium. But some of the most interesting ones are ones that have been made where they actually have like wild yeast, sort of a la San Francisco sourdough, coming in and souring the beer. And also bacteria that comes, you know, from the air.
And they're drinking this in Belgium.
They're drinking it in Belgium, and they're also doing it here as well. So some very, very interesting stuff and very creative. I mean, they have a rich tradition of brewing there where they're putting fruit in. You know, they're trying different things. And
they serve it here often with like a slice of lemon or orange, right?
Well,
or is that more of a Hefeweizen?
That's sometimes an accompaniment for a wheat beer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert, what do you have some favorite Belgian beer brands?
Oh, gee, where to begin? I suppose, let's see here. Oh, there's too many to choose. I guess I will give a shout out to my favorite Belgian restaurant, though, up in the city. La Trappe is a great place for folks who want to sample a very wide variety of Belgian beer and Belgian food. I love it.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call. And Leslie, you know, some of these beer companies sound like, I'm thinking of like Heineken, you know, which is an old beer, but it's really brewed here in the United States. I mean, are there Belgian knockoffs that are really American beer companies making Belgian sounding beers?
Yes, there are. Blue Moon is one such knockoff. It's actually a Coors product.
Really?
Yes.
Is that so? They come out of Colorado?
Yeah.
Didn't know that. I love Blue Moon.
It's a good beer. I mean, you know,
kind of fruity tasting.
Yeah, just because a beer is made by a big brewery does not necessarily mean that it is you know, it's inferior. Just, you know, it's not a small local beer. You might not like their other beers.
Not a microbrewery.
No.
Yeah. All right, let's go now to Pleasanton, and Eric is on the line. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
One trend I see is maybe greater availability of South Indian food. And the one thing that I see with that is sort of the availability of crepes, sort of the Indian crepes, the dosas, that are sort of these, it kind of looks like a burrito. They have this sort of crepe texture, but then they fill it with all different things and sort of, it's really delicious.
It is.
I see it a lot here in the East Bay.
Yeah, and there are a lot of great Indian restaurants in the East Bay, but there are, in fact, there's a restaurant here called Dosa, two of them now, and Leslie Anderson, those are good vegetarian options a lot of times too.
They are. There's also another wonderful restaurant down the street from Dosa called Udupai Palace that has similar food at a cheaper price.
Yeah. Well, there's a real difference between the Dosa on Valencia, which was the original one, and the one now in the Fillmore. I mean, that one's much more upscale.
Yes.
And much more expensive cocktails. I mean, they both have cocktails, but definitely more expensive and a, you know, fancier clientele. But the food's great. Got to say that. Let's go now to, let's see, how about Greg in East Oakland? Hi, Greg.
Hey there. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I am calling because I was listening to what you guys have going here this morning, and I Googled Chow, and I noticed that they don't have anything on underground restaurants at all. And I was very curious. I run an underground restaurant over here called Six Underground, and I just wondered if anybody's talking about the influence of this kind of dining experience.
Good question. What makes your place underground?
Well, basically, it's all word of mouth. I don't even Twitter it, Google it, or anything. I do 12 to 16 people, and I do six courses. And I've been doing it for 2 years, and I've never had any trouble putting people at the table.
How often do you serve? And, how many days a week?
About twice a month.
Twice a month.
Yeah, and I've got a from Gary Danko that works with me, and I've got a cook from New York that's been doing some stuff with me. We've been doing some East Coast stuff, but
yeah.
I just wonder, you know, I heard you guys talking about street food and the trucks and everything, and I was very interested in what people think of the underground.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the call. And Leslie, is there nothing on the website about those? Because that is definitely a trend, these sort of underground occasional restaurants. They move around from different location to location.
Yeah, we have written about it in the past. We haven't covered it recently. But, I mean, I think it's an exciting thing because it – I mean, there's just all different colors of the rainbow now with restaurants. You know, you've got sort of an invitation only situation where the food is better than you would make for a group of friends at a dinner party, you know, much fancier, much more creative. I heard recently there's a series of dinners put on by these guys that forage all their food from, you know, local parks and the cracks in the sidewalk. And I mean, it's just wonderful, all the different options that are available now for people. You don't just go to the restaurant or go to Jack in the Box and get a hamburger.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the call, Greg. We got an email from Koa in San Anselmo who writes, I believe that the cafe at Chez Panisse was doing pizza with the egg before Delfina was even in existence, which may well be the case.
You're probably right.
Probably right. And here's an email from Don who writes, why are restaurants so noisy? Do restaurateurs have an appreciation that some diners would like an atmosphere where one could carry on a conversation? Will this trend ever change? That was certainly true in the dot-com boom. There were articles written about how noisy restaurants were, and they were designed to be noisy.
I think that restaurants do think people like noise. In New York, it's even worse. They play super loud music.
They would call it buzz, I imagine.
I guess.
Yeah. Here's another email from Joan in Oakland. She writes, 30 years in the Bay Area, and I can count on one hand, with fingers to spare, the number of good New York Italian, especially pizza. The basic difference lies in the fact that the Italians who settled in the Bay Area are primarily Northern Italians, and the Italians who settled in New York are primarily Southern Italians. And she recommends, she says, I found one restaurant in Oakland and Berkeley called La Coco's. I would imagine you have some others to add to that, Leslie? I had dinner the other night at Tony's. In North Beach, a restaurant that where he claims to have won, I'm sure he did, the international pizza making contest, the first American to do that in Naples.
Oh, yeah. I heard about this place. I haven't been there, though. I'm anxious to try it. I really want to try Coco's as well.
Yeah. You never been there?
No, I haven't.
What pizza, people do have their opinions about pizza. You've got the thick, the thin, the Napolitan versions of it, deep dish. Are there trends in all of that, or is it just more pizza of all kinds?
Well, it seems like there are a lot more pizza of a certain kind. You know, the wood-fired oven, thin crust with very, very little cheese on top. I'd like to see some of that kind that Golden Boy does, not that great, but, you know, the big sheet, thick, mushy style.
Droopy, drippy cheese and stuff. All right, back to the phones, 866-733-6786. Let's hear about your favorite trend or your least favorite trend, perhaps, too. Let's go to Amelia in Napa. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to rave about a great meal I had last night at Martini House, and I had a beef pho, a Vietnamese noodle soup, and I noticed that the chef is doing something called family meal in the cellar, and he's rotating all different kinds of cuisines through for us locals who crave different kinds of ethnic foods that we can't get up here. And I just thought I would mention what a wonderful experience that was.
All right, and that's in St. Helena, right? Martini House?
Yes.
It's owned by Pat Coletto, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What about?
It's a beautiful, quiet restaurant, too.
You can talk. Well, thanks for the call. Leslie Anderson, that notion of, you know, sort of the family style, you do see that more in more restaurants nowadays where you just sort of pass the dish.
Yes, that's true. I think that's sort of where we are right now in food trends is informal, rustic. The big communal picnic style table where you can talk to your neighbor and no white tablecloths.
All right, let's see. We've got an email here from Faye who writes, Yelp is a fraud. My experience, I posted a negative review of a restaurant I went to. My review was concise and well-reasoned, yet it was deleted by Yelp. I wrote that I was a longtime customer, but that food quality had slipped and service had gone downhill. I even complimented the owner and his wife while pointing out that the quality was simply unacceptable given the prices. She goes on to say, just FYI, I have no personal axe to grind, no connection to Yelp, past or present. I'm 100% truthful in what I'm reporting. Yelp has had some controversy in the past year, and they've changed some of their policies, haven't they?
It is it's a controversial company indeed, and I, you know, everybody has a Yelp tale. We sort of like to point out that, you know, the nice thing about online recommendations is you can find good information out there. You know, some of it's suspect, some of it's not. On ChowHound, what we do is we very, very carefully curate the threads. We have moderators that are like private investigators who will go back and track down comments that look fishy, that look like they come from the owners or the owner's PR agency, and just delete those babies off there.
What about in the case of the email writer, Faye? I mean, one of the controversies with Yelp was, I believe, that if you advertised on the site, the more favorable reviews would pop up sooner, I believe. I could be misstating that. But are you aware of how they've changed their policies? And does every reasonable review get kept in a way that people can see?
You know, I honestly can't speak to what policies they've, you know, changed or are still in place. I just know that there's so much controversy around that site, but, you know, I mean, people do use it.
But I think the notion of transparency is important on any kind of bulletin board, so that people know what they're reading, what they're getting. And, you know, sometimes you get that and sometimes you don't.
And it's interesting, too, because, you know, as a longtime journalist, like you are. I mean, there were actual policies in place back in the day where you weren't supposed to accept free stuff. And, you know, if you did receive something free, you were supposed to be really out front about it. You know, I received a sample of this in the mail. I did not pay for it. However, here's my review, and, you know, which we do at Chow. But sometimes it's hard to know online when you're reading somebody's review. Who is this person? B, did they receive this meal for free? Did they walk into the restaurant and start, you know, whipping out their notebook and taking notes and taking pictures? And how did the restaurant owner respond to that? Did they maybe give them a couple free drinks? Did that maybe influence their review? We're in a whole new murky water out there.
So that may be a sort of an emerging trend, a sort of slippery ethics when it comes to some of these reviews in terms of transparency and full disclosure.
Sure. How could it not be? How could it not be?
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to the phones. Marv is on the line in San Carlos. Good morning.
Good morning. Before I mention my subject, which is tipping, that Belgian beer you were thinking about, I think, is Chimay. And I'm a very big fan of Belgian beers. Anyway, I wanted to talk about tipping. It seems to be such an automatic thing in this country to expect a tip. As a matter of fact, they've even gone to the extent of putting on the check. 10% is so much, you know, 15% expected tip, or something to that effect.
Leslie Anderson, any trends you're noticing in the tipping department?
Well, one thing that is often causing me guilt and frustration is, how much do you tip when you buy a latte? It seems sort of strange to put 10 cents in there, but, you know, what are you going to do? A dollar? That's going to be a third of the cost of your latte. I just don't have a good answer for that.
Yeah. You mentioned coffee, and that has certainly evolved over the past decade. You've got some real really outstanding local breweries, coffee houses, places like Blue Bottle, for example.
I sort of think that the coffee house, especially in San Francisco, is to 2009 what the disco was to the 70s in a way. I mean, when I walk into some of these new coffee houses, I feel like people are dressed up. It is a scene. You have a fetishization of coffee on a level that I have never seen in my life. You have these crazy Jules Verne looking machines that they're making the coffee on, and you have $8 cups of coffee, and people are roasting their own, and they're talking about, you know, flavor notes of tangerine and burnt caramel and all this stuff. And I mean, this is not Starbucks.
Yeah, but it is providing serious competition to Starbucks.
Serious competition. Now, 10 years ago, Starbucks, people were wringing their hands saying Starbucks was killing the local coffee house and, you know, support your local coffee house and this and that. Now, Starbucks is taking a page from these roasters' books. Starbucks recently acquired this company called Clover that makes these histrionic cups of coffee, you know, that take forever, very expensive, in an attempt to entice people to come back to Starbucks and think of Starbucks as being, you know, equated with quality, which people were not thinking that anymore. Mm.
You know, another trend, of course, in the coffee houses, and there's a wonderful one right down the street here, a coffee bar. But you go in there, everyone, almost everyone, has their laptops open. And it's really, it's changed the environment of the place because very few people are talking to each other.
That is true. And in fact,
maybe they're doing restaurant reviews.
I think they're just trying to get human connection.
Well, they should look over their shoulder.
But I've noticed that a few of the more styling coffee bars have actually banned laptops. Like Four Barrel Coffee does not allow laptops. They do that by not even having power outlets. So, I mean, how long can you stay on your laptop? Your battery's going
to
die.
Yeah, or some will have a minimum charge. You have to buy a certain amount before you can use the password to get the wireless code or something like that.
Right.
All right. Let's see. Here's another Yelp comment from Sonia in San Francisco. I wanted to respond to some of the comments about amateur reviewers. I'm an avid Yelp user and a less avid Yelp reviewer. I completely agree that real critics, quote unquote, real critics, have a breadth of knowledge an amateur reviewer lacks. However, one person's opinion, however learned they are about food, is subjective. Since there are so many new restaurants that I want to try, I find myself using Yelp as a way of crowdsourcing. I only trust the star ratings if there are over 100 reviews. If 80 people out of 100 loved a restaurant, I'm pretty sure the food will be good, and any outliers with a personal interest will be outweighed by everyone else. That's a pretty good guideline, I guess.
I think it is. But when I was listening to that comment, I was thinking about blockbuster movies. I mean, how many blockbuster movies do you actually like versus somebody that really knows your taste who can say, you know, there's this really weird Werner Herzog movie you got to check out. I know you like that guy.
Yeah. All right. One more thing about coffee. Blue Bottle is one of those places locally. And they have one new coffee house down on Mint Alley down by Nordstrom. But they started off down in Civic Center selling out of a back of a, I don't know what it was, a furniture store on this little window, walk-up window. They have another one of those on Folsom Street. What's that about as a marketing tool, do you think?
Well, I think people these days are more excited to go to a place that's operating out of some garage or some really raw industrial space. I think that people are looking for an adventure when they go out to have coffee or go out to experience food. And if it feels somewhat off the beaten path, or like the other caller said, you know, if it feels like it's underground, I mean, it really is more special that way than going to Whole Foods and getting something there.
Whole Foods is another trend, though. They've been sprouting like weeds. I mean, I don't know how many there were in the Bay Area a decade ago, but boy, there's new ones opening up. It seems like every other week in the Bay Area.
Indeed. This isn't the Bay Area, but when I was doing my research over, you know, the past 10-year food trends, I was looking at the city of Atlanta. And in 1999, there was one Whole Foods in Atlanta, and now there are six.
Yeah, definitely. And that has had an influence on other supermarket chains like Safeway, I think.
Sure. Well, 10 years ago, if you wanted to buy organic food, you had to get it from a CSA, a health food store, you know, community supported agriculture, a health food store. You know, some grocery stores in the Bay Area carried a little bit. But nowadays, you know, partly due to the impact of Whole Foods and partly, you know, just consumer demand, you can get organic food at Walmart. I mean, look at how far we've come. For better or for worse, you can get it at Walmart.
And, you know, one of the people who's weighed in on that whole discussion is Michael Pollan from UC Berkeley with his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. He's had a huge impact in the last few years on the conversation and in the food industry and how people are looking at organic and local food.
Indeed. Michael Pollan really changed the way that people think about where their food came from. And it wasn't just Michael Pollan. You know, there were two other things that happened in the last 10 years that I think really, you know, woke people up a little bit. There was the movie Super Size Me, and then there was the book Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser. And, you know, these three books, I think, working together, I mean, you know, there's been other stuff too, but I think people just thinking about where your food came from and the impact on the planet that the choices that you make have moved from the fringe into the mainstream. And, you know, to the point where mainstream Americans are using the words local and sustainable and asking where their food is coming from.
And, of course, all that, especially the supersizing, very much related to diet and health. A lot of obesity
Indeed.
In this country. Let's go back to the phones. And Donnie is on the line in Cotati. Hi, Donnie.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say that with this economy, I have not been able to eat out in my favorite restaurants like I used to, Thai food, Mexican food, and I started looking at these cultures as places where people typically use the cheaper cuts of meats and how to use what they're cooking, their raw materials, to make the foods that I loved, and discovered pozole, discovered how to make all the Thai curries, and then discovered that those foods are really very inexpensive, and I was paying top dollar eating in the restaurants. And I'm wondering how many other people may have discovered the same thing. And there's so many different markets around Mexican, carniceria, the Asian markets, et cetera, and the food is a lot cheaper there than it is in our local grocery stores.
Yeah, good point.
So that's been a direction that I've gone, and it's actually been better for us.
Leslie, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, it's great to hear you say that, because anytime you discover how to make something that you love in a restaurant that you can no longer afford at home, I mean, what a great victory, right? One of my resolutions for 2010 is to learn how to make Japanese food, not necessarily sushi, but, you know, hot pots and things like that. Learn how to get the spices right. But, you know, one thing that people might consider looking into and learning about is braising, is, you know, low, slow cooking. And you don't need to have a slow cooker to do that. You can actually do it in a pot with a tight fitting lid in the oven if you're home all day. And the braising typically makes use of those cheaper cuts of meat because they tend to be a little tougher. But if you cook them for a long time and throw in some root vegetables and, you know, whatever spice you like, they're quite fork tender and delicious.
And braising is basically cooking in liquid, right?
Submerging in liquid, cooking low and slow.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Teresa in Oakland has sent us an email. She writes, we deserve good Cuban food in the Bay Area. It's a travesty that we don't have it here. Any thoughts about Cuban restaurants? There are a few here and there, but nothing like you find, say, in Florida, of course, or even New York City.
I agree. I want some Cuban food right now.
Okay. You know what they can get? You can get I don't know if it's authentic or not, but Byright Market on 18th Street, they have a Fidel sandwich, like a pulled pork sandwich, which is Cuban. It's good. I don't know if it's authentic, but it's good.
I'll have to try that.
Scott in Oakland writes, I recently read that the fastest growing segment of the packaged food industry are vegan products, with Jonathan Safran Foers, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that, his recent book called Eating Animals. It seems to be, this is perhaps for ethical, environmental, and health reasons, the single most important trend in food. Can your guest address her take on veganism and how she feels it will shape the debate on what's hot and what's not?
I think that is a really excellent question, because I think, you know, if we're back here 10 years from now, that is what we're going to be talking about almost 100%.
That being?
Veganism and meat eating in general. There's a lot of talk about it in Jonathan Safran Foer's book, obviously, but there's more to come. And in fact, there was a very interesting study that came out recently from the World Bank that said that half of greenhouse gases are caused by livestock farming.
And that comes from the nitrogen and so on that goes into the feed.
Yeah, and you know, the methane gas produced. It's a tremendous amount of resources, and as third world countries become more westernized in their diets, you know, history has shown us that they eat more meat. And so this is a problem that's going to need to be addressed, particularly as it relates to global warming and as it relates to people's health. Because, I mean, let's face it, we should all be eating a little less meat in our diets.
And my producer, Tina Lauerberg, sent me a note saying there are a couple of good Cuban restaurants in San Francisco, Paladar Cafe Cubano and La Parija Grill, which I think is in the Mission also. So there are some options. And let's see, we had another email here from Michael, who writes, on the topic of Italian cuisine, both northern and southern, I just wanted to mention a hidden gem on the border of Albany and Berkeley on San Pablo Avenue called Mangia Mangia. I give it a 10.
Ooh.
She's scribbling that down. You know, another trend that comes to mind, comfort foods like donuts and ice cream. But not just, you know, standard fare. You've got Humphrey Slocum again in the Mission here in San Francisco with flavors like bourbon and cornflakes, salt and pepper, curry peanut butter. What's up with that?
Well, that's a fun trend, and the two places you mentioned are within walking distance of each other on the eastern side of 24th Street, so you could hit them both in one day. I think what that's about is people want comfort food. You know, it's sort of the cliche that when times are tough, you know, you revert to pot roast and meatloaf and chocolate chip cookies and so on and so forth. But you have these professional chefs that have worked in, you know, high-end restaurants and they're pros. And they're not going to be content with just making the same old French crouler or apple fritter over and over and over again. These are artists, and so they want to express themselves. And like in the case of Dynamo Donuts, you have things like Star Anise chocolate. And I think she
Huckleberry.
I think she was one of the first people to do the now ubiquitous maple bacon donut.
Right, right. And there's a bacon a maple latte that you can get at Pirate Radio Cafe, too.
I've heard that's kind of nasty.
Though. I haven't had it. I'm not going to try it, I don't think. But, you know, but again, the donut, you know, Dynamo Donut, great donuts, but they're not – I mean, we think of donuts as being, you know, kind of working class or, you know, relatively inexpensive. And I guess they are compared to some things, but, you know, $2.50, $3 for a donut.
Yeah, I have friends that on a matter of principle will not eat those donuts because they feel like it's a travesty. A donut should be, you know, less than a buck. I like the donuts. It's just a different donut experience. You know, you walk down there and you get a Stumptown coffee and you have a donut and
yeah,
it's special. It's
a simple pleasure, or not simple, but relatively cheap. So just a few minutes left, looking ahead to 2010. What are you looking for?
I'm excited about the trend of local. Now we've been hearing local for a while now, but it's like that word and that concept is getting more and more micro to the point where I think I mentioned before, people are keeping bees in their backyard, people are keeping chickens in their backyard. I heard about a new market that was opening in Bernal Heights that will be similar to the Ferry Plaza in that it will have stalls for vendors. But I mean, imagine in a small neighborhood like Bernal to give that opportunity to very small producers. And that's exciting because when you have something like that, then your neighbor can start their caramel business.
And, of course, means you don't have to get in your car, which is good for the environment as well.
More walking.
Leslie Anderson, senior editor of Chow.com. Thanks for being here. It was a fun hour.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. I'm Scott Schaefer, here for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.